Disclaimer: the following episode contains mention of violence and sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised. We do not support underage drinking, excessive drinking, binge drinking, or any other unsafe drinking behavior. Please drink responsibly, never drink and drive. Hey guys, welcome to the Conundrum Bar. We're your hosts, Leanza,
Raquel,
and Abby.
And join us in covering a new conundrum every Friday, from murder to mystery to alien sightings and even some supernatural occurrences. Along the way, you'll meet all of our fur babies and their quirky traits. We'll share our favorite cocktails so you can sip along as we try to solve these crazy conundrums together. Now I'll turn you over to Raquel for a knowledge drink of the week. And in case you guys didn't know, knowledge drink of the week is Natalia's fur baby, the dog mom right over here. So I just thought I'd introduce Nala to you guys, and I'll turn you over to Raquel. Alright, so Nala's drink of the week, like Vance stated, is the Atomic Hulk, which is 1 ounce of tequila, 1 ounce of blue raspberry vodka, and then 1 ounce of French vodka blend. And this week, Natalia wants to substitute her tequila for just some plain vodka, and Leanza will be getting half the dosage, because that's how she likes it. Not really likes it, but she'll try. She tries. She doesn't like the taste of alcohol. So it does not matter which order you do it, it's all going in the same cup. So now we'll do the plain vodka for Molly.
There it is.
Those weren't the options.
Surprise me.
I'm giving you tequila.
So, in case you guys were wondering, this is a pretty drink and a dangerous drink.
Yes, the Atomic Hulk is nothing to play with, but it is delicious. And I also forgot to mention that you chopped it with Mountain Dew.
Be as pretty. I'm sorry. I don't care. I like how the shortest person here got the tallest glass.
I think I'm sure.
I don't think so.
And there you have it, the Atomic Hulk. You can also garnish it with a slice of lime if you want to be fancy, but who has time for that? The Atomic Hulk.
In October of 2011, more than 100 men responded to an employment ad on Craigslist. All they had to do was look after a big farm, they'd get a weekly salary and housing. No one suspected that this dream job was the ruse of a killer. Pull up a stool as we cover the conundrum of the Craigslist killer. So, as we said, in October of 2011, more than 100 men responded to an employment ad on Craigslist, which I am going to have one of you read the ad, because I have the actual ad.
Leanza, do you want to read it?
Yes, yeah, sure.
Caretaker position for farm, Southern Ohio. Simply watch over 688-acre patch of hilly farmland and feed a few cows. You get $300 a week and a nice two-bedroom trailer. Someone older and single preferred, but will consider all. Relocation is a must. You must have a clean record and be trustworthy. This is a permanent position. The farm is used mainly as a hunting preserve, is overrun with game, has a stocked 3-acre pond, but some beef cattle will be kept. Nearest neighbor is a mile away. The place is secluded and beautiful. It will be a real getaway for the right person. Job of a lifetime. If you are ready to relocate, please contact ASAP. Position will not stay open. include name, age, phone number in the email, please.
So that was the ad that came out on Craigslist in October of 2011. I don't know if you guys kind of got a hint of it, but the ad was tailored to a very specific kind of person. A middle-aged man who was single, never married, or recently divorced. So it was very suited to that person. David Pauley was a 51-year-old from Norfolk, Virginia, and he was one of the men that responded to this ad. At the time, he was divorced and was living with his older brother. He had been unemployed for about 2 years, bouncing from job to job, but unable to find any steady work. David usually looked for jobs around the Norfolk area, but his friend from high school, who he kept in touch with, named Chris, he had recently, in the last couple of years, moved to Ohio. So David kind of figured, why not? You know, he was divorced, he was living on his brother's couch. He figured this was the perfect way to start a new life. He responded to the ad. He said that he was 51, single, loved the outdoors, and liked to be alone. He was a hard worker and he had his own truck, which would be a help around the farm. A few days later, he got a response that he was one of three candidates. He was asked questions like, are you married? Have you ever been arrested? A few days later, got a call that he had been chosen for the job. He was so excited that he immediately called Chris, and they agreed that they'd get together the first weekend after he settled in. So a little background on him and Chris. They had been friends since high school, and they kept in touch all the time, and they specifically bought walkie-talkies to keep in touch, it said. But the thing that I find interesting is that Chris lived in Rocky River, Ohio, which is about 563 miles or 906 kilometers away from Norfolk, Virginia. So I don't know what the heck kind of walkie-talkies they had.
Yeah, because even Daniel drives a semi and his CB don't even reach.
He has a tiny little itty-bitty one for that purpose, but still it only reaches out like couple hundred miles, if that.
Yeah, so I thought that was really interesting, but like the articles that I read specifically said walkie-talkies. Don't know what kind. They had some special walkie-talkies, but yes.
But if you guys know, then go ahead and message us, because I think I want one of those walkie-talkies.
Instead of phones, we'll just walkie-talkie each other all the time.
It kind of reminds me of Stranger Things, like, I wonder if it was.
That's so true. Sometime that week, David had gone to his men's Bible study group, and they gave him $300 to help with his move. He used the money to rent a U-Haul. He packed up all of his stuff, which included some model trains, some books, DVDs, and some Christmas lights. On Saturday, October 22nd, 2011, David arrived to the Red Roof Inn at Parkersburg, West Virginia, which is about 17 minutes away from Marietta, Ohio.
Yes, I have a question. Did his brother know where he was going? Because you said he was sleeping on his brother's couch. Did he know he was going to the specific place? Like, he knew the address?
Yes. Okay. So he did tell his brother, and it had mentioned that his brother was, like, an ex-Navy man, so he was always pressuring him to, like, cut his hair and, like, look nice for an interview. And that was one of these things for this interview. He's like, I'm going to be on a 688-acre farm. Who cares what I look like? So he kind of just felt like it was another reason. You know, mm-hmm. It was meant for him. So, anyways, he got to the hotel, which was about 17 minutes away from Marietta, Ohio, where he was supposed to meet with his employer for breakfast. He then called his twin sister, Deb, and she told him that she loved him and to check in with her the next day. He then called Chris, his best friend, who asked him to send him an exact location once he had settled in so that they could get together that weekend.
Oh, Chris.
Right? On Sunday, October 23rd, 2011, the following day, David, new employer, and his nephew, Brogan, had David park his truck in the parking lot of a food center emporium. He got in the car with them after Jack, his employer, told him that the road to the farm was needing repairs before he could bring the truck and trailer up. After about a 15 to 20 minute drive, according to Google Maps, from what I could tell, they pulled over on a hillside that was densely wooded. Jack explained to David that he had left some equipment down the hill by a creek, and they needed to get it before they could repair the road. When they went down the hill, they got to the creek. He, for some reason, decided to go back up the hill. So David and Rafferty, Brogan Rafferty, which was the nephew, followed Jack up the hill, but Brogan said that he needed to use the restroom. When he came back, David was on the ground, face down, with his cowboy hat hanging from a branch. He had been shot in the back of the head by Jack.
I was just thinking they would want to get to work right away without showing him the farm,
right? Yeah, no, he wasn't messing around, but in another way. Sunday had gone by without a word from David. Chris called David's brother, who gave him the number for his new employer, Jack. He contacted Jack, and Jack told him that everything was fine. He had left David with a list of chores to do, and that's why he hadn't gotten back to him, but he would pass along the message. After going another few days without hearing from David, Chris decided to call Jack again. Jack told him that he had arrived to the farm and found David packing everything back up and telling him that he had met a man in town who was going to Pennsylvania for work on a drilling rig and had decided to go with him instead. Chris, of course, couldn't believe this because they had been friends since high school. They talked, to his estimation, up to 50 times a day sometimes. So they were super close, and he couldn't believe that there was any way that he would just pick up and leave without a word.
That's question. Like, way off.
Yeah, sorry, question. The walkie-talkie distance now that he was moving to Ohio, do you have that?
So to answer your question, they were now about 2 hours away from each other and about 126 miles or 202 kilometers. So they were a lot closer.
So the walkie-talkies definitely would be where they would be talking probably 50 times a day.
Probably, yeah. At least it should be, right?
Which, this guy seems like a good friend because I honestly talk to you guys like, what, once, maybe twice a week.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. And good thing we all have tracking apps. We all can track each other nowadays.
That's very true, because when I don't hear from you, I do check and make sure where you are, because I'm like, and then sometimes I'm like, what the heck is Leanza doing over there? So, it is a good thing.
I don't do nothing, guys.
No, sometimes you go to Rio Rancho without telling us.
Yeah, that was a shock.
Apologies. So, anyways, 2 weeks went by since Chris had last talked to David. And this would put us in early November of 2011. He decided to call Dem, David's twin sister, who also hadn't heard from him and was becoming increasingly worried. Before she received the call from Chris, she had already started her own investigation. She had called the motel in Parkersburg, the U-Haul rental place, and a few other places, but had gotten no new information. We'll come back to David in a little bit. On November 9th, 2011, Scott Davis sat in the backseat of his new employer's car after responding to an ad on Craigslist a month prior. His new employer, Jack, and a young man he introduced as his nephew, Brogan, sat in the front seat of the white Buick LeSabre. Scott, who was 48 at the time, decided to leave his girlfriend, give away accounts for his landscaping business, and packed up his things, including his Harley, to move to Ohio for this job.
Leanne's his face.
So they're trying to find people that, like, nobody will, like,
miss,
but it seems like, some people are missing them.
Right, which is actually a big part of the story and why I was attracted to it, which I think we'll talk about it later.
Okay.
He had said he was moving partly to help care for his mother, who lived just outside of Akron, Ohio, which is about an hour and 20 minutes north of Cambridge, Ohio, where the farm was located. Jack had told him to make sure to bring his Harley because there was, quote, plenty of beautiful rural roads, unquote. Scott had met Jack and Brogan for breakfast in Marietta, where they asked what he had brought with him. Scott told them that his trailer was full from top to bottom with tools, clothes, and stereo equipment, and of course, he had brought his Harley.
Side note, a Harley on dirt roads in the country does not sound like a fun time to me.
No. Rocks and eyes.
Yeah, probably not. So after breakfast, Scott followed them to the Food Center Emporium in Caldwell, parked his truck in the parking lot, and hopped in the car with him. Jack again told him that the road to the farm was needing repairs before he could bring the truck and trailer up, And after about 15 minutes of driving, they turned to dirt road and all cell signal disappeared. Jack told Brogan, who was driving, to pull over, quote, where we got that deer last time, unquote, on a hillside that was densely wooded. He explained to Scott that he had left some equipment down the hill by a creek and they needed to get it before they could repair the roof.
These guys are like, no, never mind.
Scott followed Jack down the hillside, but then Jack seemed to get lost and kind of forget where they put the equipment and suggested that they turn around and head back. Scott turned around, headed up the hill, this time with Jack following behind him. Next thing Scott heard was click and when he turned around, he saw Jack pointing a gun at his head. The first shot had jammed. Scott immediately threw his hands up to cover his face, and he felt his right elbow shatter from the second shot. He turned around and ran as fast as he could, all the while Jack kept shooting at him. He ran until he couldn't hear any more shots. He couldn't hear any more footsteps after him. And he came back to the main road where he quickly crossed it, scared that Jack and Brogan were still following him or looking for him. He hid in the woods for 7 hours. Finally, when the sun started going down, he got back on the road and started walking. By this time, he had lost a lot of blood. His right sleeve and pant leg were completely soaked in blood. After walking for miles, he found a house, knocked on the door, and the homeowners opened the door. They found a pale, fidgety, blood-soaked man, but thankfully, they called 911.
That's good.
After about 15 minutes, the sheriff, Stephen Hannum, arrived. He described Scott as, quote, remarkably coherent for a man who had been shot and was bleeding heavily, unquote. However, the sheriff thought that Scott's story made no sense. A 688-acre cattle ranch. There was nothing even close to that big in Cambridge, at least not anything that was privately owned. Anything that big was owned by the mining companies.
So maybe where they were shooting people was just some random spot they knew of. It wasn't even their own land.
Right?
Yeah.
So he also thought it was weird that Scott kept mentioning that Jack was probably going to sell his Harley. He was very concerned that Jack was going to sell his Harley. Hannum, the sheriff, figured that Scott was part of a drug deal gone bad. To him, he was a middle-aged white guy with long hair, jean jacket, and a Harley. So he figured he was part of a drug deal and it didn't turn out the way he wanted it to. So the sheriff made some calls to some local informants, but no one had heard anything. Next, he went to the parking lot of Food Center Emporium, and just as Scott had said, his truck and trailer were there. Hannum said, quote, it was beginning to look like Mr. Davis truly was a victim rather than whatever I thought he was at the beginning.
Oh my gosh. Well, if you're going to get shot in a drug deal, you're probably not going to go to the cops.
Probably not.
Or you would admit, hey, we were trying to sell drugs and I got shot. These guys, you know.
And he said at the beginning, didn't he say he sounded super coherent for being shot? Like, you think if he was doing drugs, he wouldn't be, like, able to tell a story straight.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, even if he was part of a drug deal and he was telling this story as a cover-up, like, why would you go with a 688-acre ranch off of Craigslist and, like, put all these details into that when you could probably get away with a much simpler story?
Right. If you're
gonna lie to the cops. Anyways. On Friday, November 11th, 2011, David's sister, remembered the name of the town where David had said that the farm was located, Cambridge, Ohio. She did a quick Google search, and she came across an article that headlined, Man says he was lured here for work, then shot. After reading the article, she came across the same 688-acre farm detail. She immediately called the sheriff's office, where she spoke to Hannum, and informed him that her brother had also moved there for work on a 688-acre ranch and she hasn't heard from him since.
I have a question. Did the sheriff, when this happened to that guy, did he look into Craigslist to see if he could find the ad?
So one of the articles that I read did say that Scott told him about the ad and showed him the ad, but that's all that I found.
Mm.
So it does say that he knew about it at least, but I don't think they were taking it that seriously yet until he got the second call about a potential second victim. So after you kill one person and another, your second person escapes, like the logical thing would to just be either like leave town or lie low, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wrong. On Sunday, November 13th, 2011, Brogan and Jack picked up Timothy Kern from a pizzeria parking lot in Canton, Ohio, which is about 27 minutes south of Akron, or 23 miles, 37 kilometers. Timothy was 47, divorced, and had recently lost his job as a street cleaner, so he had been sleeping in his car. I know, sad, right? Almost as soon as Timothy had gotten into the car, Jack began asking him questions. When they talked, he had mentioned a laptop. Did he bring it with him? He had also mentioned a flat-screen TV. Did he bring that with him? Timothy explained that no, he had left most everything of value behind for his sons. The only thing that he had brought was clothes, cassette tapes, and his sedan that barely ran, which he left in the parking lot. Timothy had a close relationship with his sons, who at that time were 19 and 17, and he saw the job as good, but with drawbacks, because he would be more than 2 hours away from his sons and with no cell service. He was constantly texting them and spending as much time as possible with them. One article that I read even said that he would wait around the corner until their mom left for work just to be able to go and visit with them. So, the day that Timothy left for Ohio, one of his sons texted him, quote, "I love you, I miss you, I'm proud of you," unquote. This time, Jack, Brogan, and Timothy headed to a wooded area behind a mall in Akron, where Jack and Brogan had already dug a shallow 2-foot-deep grave the night before.
I have a question, Lace. Were there meeting? Is it still the same cafe that they're meeting? Like, is the cafe noticing, like, the same people and the cars getting left there for, like...
No. So, they did park the two first ones, Scott and David's, at the Food Center Emporium, but that was just in the parking lot. And the Marietta, where they had breakfast, I believe, with David. I don't know where they had breakfast with Scott. And then Timothy, they picked up from a parking lot of a pizzeria. Oh. So they were at different locations.
And then I have one more question, sorry. It was, the Craigslist ad. Mm-hmm. Like, was it the same Craigslist ad that we're using over? No one would comment on it and saying they had people going missing. It wasn't taken down by, like, whoever owns Craigslist or nothing?
Not that I can tell. From what I can tell, it was like... He posted the ad in October, and he's picking his victims from the people that responded at that time. Mm-hmm. So he's just, like, you know, picking as he goes along.
Okay.
At least from what I can tell. So, since it was a Sunday, and that particular mall that they went to was pretty much entirely out of business, except for, like, one small shop, and it was Sunday, so it was closed. There was no one there. After they parked, Jack told Timothy that they had been squirrel hunting earlier in the woods behind the mall, and that he had lost his watch, so if they could go look for it. Brogan would later describe that when they went to go look for the watch, he heard a pop and then saw Timothy fall to his knees, holding the side of his head. He kept taking, quote, "enormous gulps of air," unquote. And finally, after 5 shots, he stopped breathing.
It's a little excessive.
Yeah. That night, Timothy's son tried to call him, but figured he was just settling in. After a few days with no response, he got so worried to the point that he would even sleep with his phone next to him in hopes of hearing from his dad. He'd check his voicemail every morning as soon as he woke up, because they had gone from constant contact to none. On November 14th, 2011, 5 days after they picked up Scott and after the call from Deb, the sheriff's office found surveillance footage from Scott's breakfast with Jack and Brogan. After they realized they had a potential serial killer on the loose, they contacted an FBI cybercrime specialist to see if they could track down who had posted the Craigslist ad. They sent a team with cadaver dogs out to the area where Scott had been shot, and they were able to find a patch of disturbed soil that had been covered with tree branches. After digging with their hands for a bit, they uncovered blood soaking through the dirt and a salt-covered foot.
I wish they would have taken the dogs out after the first time.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. So they discovered the body laying face down, and they removed a corded black leather bracelet from the body, and they later called Deb, David's sister, described the bracelet to her, and she was able to confirm that yes, it was her brother David. Shortly after that, they discovered a second grave, and an empty one, what they believed was meant for Scott. Early the following week, the investigators identified the man in the footage, Richard Beasley.
Not Jack.
But not only that, the cybercrime specialist from the FBI had gotten enough information from Craigslist that he was able to track the IP address of the original computer to a house in Akron. The homeowner said that he had never written any ads on Craigslist, and he didn't know anyone named Richard or Jack. However, when they showed him a picture of the man in question, he did recognize him. That wasn't Richard or Jack. That was Ralph.
Who's Ralph?
Yeah. We're getting to that. Not only did he identify him as Ralph, but he had said that until recently, he had been renting a room from him for $100 a week. He described him as, quote, a nice guy, didn't smoke, didn't drink, went to church, unquote.
Gosh. Is that where they got all their stuff to put a Craigslist ad up, or where they're staying right there?
Possibly. And as a matter of fact, he had just left him a note with his new cell phone number. So the landlord called him and was able to keep him on the phone long enough for the police to trace the call. On November 16th, 2011, an FBI SWAT team arrested the wanted man outside another house in Akron, and he was identified as Richard Beasley. Meanwhile, a detective and an FBI agent interviewed 16-year-old Brogan Rafferty in the principal's office of his school while another team searched his house. And later that evening, he was taken into custody.
He's so young.
Very young. So, a little background on Beasley, so that, and then we'll go into this whole who's who thing. Beasley had previously worked as a machinist and had been briefly married, where he had a daughter who was roughly the age of Brogan Rafferty, about 16 years old. His work had been interrupted on multiple occasions by his time in jail. From 1985 to 1990, he served in the Texas prison for burglary. From 1996 to 2003, he served in federal prison for a firearms charge. And in the mid-2000s, he sustained head, chest, and spinal injuries after an accident with a dump truck. And after his return from prison and all of this, he told everyone that he had found God and started attending church. He went to Bible study and volunteered at a soup kitchen. He had become a chaplain, although technically he wasn't ordained. He said he was training, which is exactly how he met Brogan Rafferty. At age 8, Brogan had wanted to start going to church, and his father gave him the okay to start going with Richard, who he knew from a local motorcycle club they were in. For 8 years, Beasley would pick up Brogan on Sundays for church, sometimes taking his daughter Tanya or Brogan's half-sister with him, but every Sunday. In 2009, Beasley started a halfway house to help reform addicts, prostitutes, and runaways, right, because he was a man of God. However, according to one of the women that previously stayed there with about four or five other women, she said that shortly after he began advertising online and taking them to meet men, essentially becoming their pimp.
Oh my gosh.
She said that he would buy drugs and do anything necessary to keep them there. Even though he was never violent with them, she said she was afraid of him. So, later, in February of 2011, he was arrested on drug charges and was released on bond in July. And after he failed to check in with his parole officers from earlier crimes, a warrant for his arrest was issued. In early August, Beasley began going to homeless shelters looking for someone that looked like him. He had told Brogan that he needed a new identity because there was a warrant out for him for crimes he didn't commit. He would present himself as a generous employer looking to give someone the job of a lifetime. Soon, he met Ralph Geiger, who once had worked in maintenance but eventually ran out of work. At that time, he was 56 years old and staying at the shelter while he tried to get back on his feet. On August 9, 2011, Beasley, Brogan, and Ralph headed southeast out of Caldwell up onto Rado Ridge, or Rado Ridge. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Feel free to correct me. And turned onto Don Warner Road, going midway down the hill, and took an old two-track road. After getting out of the car, Beasley shot Ralph in the back of the head and buried him in a grave about 4 feet deep. Beasley calmly removed Ralph's driver's license and social security card. And according to GQ magazine, if you left the two-track and went all the way down the hill, you'd find where David Pauley was buried later. And about 50 feet away from that was where you'd find the grave meant for Scott.
Oh my gosh.
So shortly after the murder of Ralph Geiger, Beasley began assuming his identity. He sold the few possessions that Ralph had and spent the money within a few weeks. He dyed his hair brown, went to the doctor for painkillers from his previous accident, and he found a room to rent. He even got a job, but didn't stay there long because he was worried that his parole officers would catch on to his little act.
Screws.
And this was the first victim and the beginning of the Craigslist killings. On November of 2012, a jury convicted Rafferty, Brogan Rafferty, of 3 counts aggravated murder and 1 count attempted murder. He was sentenced to life without parole for 70 years.
Dang. I was going to ask, like, how was he okay with this? Did you find any?
So from what I read, Brogan said that he had originally told the investigators that he didn't know that Beasley was going to kill Ralph, but then later he changed it that he did know. Mm. He had said that after the first murder, he became scared for his life, and he was scared that if he didn't go along with it, that Beasley was going to kill him or possibly his mom or his half-sister. So that was his reasoning for going with it.
Well, you said that the ladies he had under his house were even afraid of him, even though he wasn't violent, so.
Yeah. And actually, a week after they had taken Brogan into custody, the police had actually made a deal to only charge him with complicity to murder and attempted murder in the case of David Pauley and Scott Davis if he testified against Beasley. But later, he backed out of the deal. However, the judge did allow the recorded interview to be played at trial.
So he could have not gotten guilty, but he got the guilty verdict.
Yeah, so he could have just been charged with helping with the murder and attempted murder instead of 3 counts of murder and 1 attempted murder. So, but yeah, that was the story behind him. I mean, from the articles that I read,
they did say that Brogan looked up to Beasley like a father figure, because I guess Brogan's father, the way that he described him, was very strict because his mom and dad had gotten divorced early on. And from the interviews with his dad said that, yeah, he was strict with him and he had to grow up fast, but that was because he was constantly at work trying to, you know, provide for
support
them.
Support the family.
Yeah, so I guess Brogan took it in a negative way and kind of resented his dad, and then saw Beasley as a father figure that he never really had.
Those things are like harder to understand until you're paying the bills one day.
Yeah, exactly. Later, in April of 2013, Beasley was convicted of murder, kidnapping, and robbery, and he was sentenced to death. In September of 2020, Richard Beasley went in front of a judge for resentencing due to a procedural error during his first sentencing. So there was like some issues with the paperwork, like they didn't phrase something right when they first sentenced him, so he had to go for a resentencing. Ultimately, he was resentenced to death and is still waiting on death row. And that's it. That's the Greg Six killings.
Man, that's crazy.
Yeah. I just thought this story was kind of crazy because he was relying on these people that could just walk away from their lives. No one would miss them. No one would notice. But every single one of his victims had someone that was missing them and looking for them, even though they were down on their luck, out of work, living on someone's couch.
Yeah.
Like, they still all had someone looking out for them. So, I don't
know. That's good.
Yeah. The story just kind of, I like that.
Yeah, I would say Thor's advice, if you're going to get a job somewhere, do some research on it, because the fact that there were no ranches that big there is insane.
That's my thoughts, too. I was going to say, if I ever get a job anywhere random, I'm pretty sure that my brothers and most of my family will come and check it out before they'd allow me to, like, just move somewhere. So if you got a family, that friend that's moving somewhere, just go check it out. Make sure it's real.
And I want to show you guys some pictures of, like, who they are and the victims and some other stuff, which we will have on the website so you guys can look along as well. So that is Richard Beasley,
Ralph,
and Jack.
Yes.
That is Brogan Rafferty. And that is David Pauly, his second victim. This one is Timothy Kern, his last victim. That is Ralph Geiger, the one who he took his identity.
Okay, I could kind of see it.
Just a little bit. This one is Scott Davis, the one that got away. And this is the grave that they found that was meant for Scott. And I thought this was kind of cool. So that's the ad. And then this is actually a map that shows where they got out of the car with Scott, where Scott was shot, where he hid from Beasley, and where he finally got to the house was able to call the cops. Yeah, like, look how far that is.
He was determined to live and survive. That's awesome.
Yeah. Like, you guys need to take a look at this picture, because he went miles while bleeding out.
Well, adrenaline, you don't know what you'll do when you're like...
And that was another thing I was going to say. Why would they leave their vehicle? I'm sorry, I'm not going to get in a vehicle with somebody. Like, I'm going to take my vehicle, or I'm not going with you.
Yeah. And, like, the whole purpose of him having them leave the car and the trailer was that after he killed them, he'd go back, take everything, and he'd go pawn it. So that was his whole purpose. Like, he'd try to find out what they were bringing with them to see how much money he could make.
I have a question. How long ago was this?
2011.
I was thinking it was further out when people are more trusting. Like, nowadays people don't really, like...
No, I'd be like, my truck has four-wheel drive, I'll make it down that road, I'm fine.
But what's funny, though, is, like, they said they had trucks, right?
And they got into a Buick LeSabre with them. Like, how is how is that going to make it any better than a truck is? Like,
well, maybe their thinking is they didn't want them to damage their vehicle. They would rather
That could be, but still.
I don't know. So this is the towns where that we talked about. So Akron, Canton, Cambridge, where the farm was located, Caldwell, and Marietta. So we mentioned all of these at some point. This was Caldwell, and this is where I said that they went down Don Warner Road. So this is supposedly where the 680-acre ranch was.
Okay.
So yeah. Like saying 11 miles?
Yeah, 21 minutes from Caldwell.
And that's it. That's the conundrum of this week, guys.
And that's crazy.
It's now last call. Thank you guys for tuning in. We'll see you guys next week to go over the next conundrum. Please remember to always drink responsibly. Don't follow my lead. Never drink and drive. And please remember to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, subscribe to our YouTube so you can watch all our priceless reactions. Stay suspicious, stay strong, and stay savvy. Good night.
Bye.
Bye.